I have the pleasure to introduce to you Professor Haugen, whom you certainly know beforehand. But I couldn't help myself to memorize the very first time I saw his name in a publication. It was in the 40s, which kind of indicates my own age, I suppose. My first reaction was that this name certainly sounds Norwegian. I wonder if he might be of Norwegian descent. Now, later on, we certainly have realized that he wasn't only of Norwegian descent, but had an extremely great interest in Norway. And came here, as you remember, in 51, helping us starting up the curriculum in chemical engineering. And today he's going to speak about his own 50 years experience in the development of chemical engineering education. So that you can see.
Now, Mr. Chairman, fellow colleagues, my original name was Fjellhaugen, but I believe that my grandfather knocked the fjell out of it. It is indeed a pleasure to be here again. My privilege to be associated with Norges Tekniske Høgskole in the spring of 1951. When Professor Terjesen was struggling very hard to establish a curriculum in chemi technique, following somewhat the pattern adopted in the United States, all branches of engineering stem from Europe. However, the pattern of chemical engineering education as taught in the United States is quite original there. Well, since being here in 51, I've had first-hand contact with instruction in chemical engineering and industrial chemistry in 20 countries around the world, in Europe and in Central America and in Asia, Canada, in the Near East and in the Far East. I want to share some of these experiences with you. Pleasure also to return and note the tremendous great progress that has been made here in the expansion of its staff and buildings and laboratories, equipment. It's also a pleasure to meet former friend and those who have studied with us at Wisconsin. These include Professor Axel Ederson and his family, who were with us 2.5 years, and similarly Glør Mädel and his family. One of the first students in our department was Reidar Lunde. We've also had Bjørn Lykke, Ragnar Evjen, and Hans Bjøntegard is with us now. You also in the Department of Chemie Technique have had Professor Molsted from the University of Pennsylvania and Sigelski from the University of Minnesota, and Dr. Greencorn, Richard Koch, and Roger Elton from Wisconsin. Now, I told Dr. Lederson that this lecture would be of interest primarily to the instructional staff of Chemie Technique and perhaps to no others, so I'm very pleased to see such a large staff of Chemie Technique. It's quite appropriate that I talk about this 50 years of development in chemical engineering, because This institution is celebrating its jubilee year, 50th year. And our American Institute of Chemical Engineers just celebrated its 50 years. And my own professional career also covers 50 years. Well, the term chemical engineering is unfortunately used rather ambiguously. It means two different things when referring to the curriculum in the United States and the rest of the world. The pattern of industrial chemistry, sometimes called chemical engineering, was developed in Germany over 60 years ago. The second pattern, which we designate as chemical engineering, originated in the United States about 35 years ago. Now at this institution, you have both patterns. And of course, they're equally justified. In the United States, we delay instruction in industrial chemistry until after graduation to special institutions. But here you have both undergraduate training. And it's essential also in a country like Japan, where the ratio of industrial chemistry to chemical engineering was about 20 to 1. In the United States, it's just about 0 to 1 for undergraduate instruction. You'll be interested to know that the origin of my interest in the field of chemical engineering is due to a visit by Dr. Sam Ide of Rukan to the West Coast in the year 1909. He is the joint inventor of the Birkeland-Ide process, and he came to Seattle to attend the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition. That's celebrating the great gold rush in Alaska in the year 1909, when Seattle was then a dynamic, booming, Wild West city. And like Norway, hydroelectric power was cheap and abundant. And of course, he foresaw the development of a fertilizer industry on the West Coast in the production of a cheap nitric acid. It is also interesting to know that this very promising process died within 5 years, commercially, due to the development of the Haber process. In 1911, with four other students, I entered as a freshman at the University of Washington in Seattle. And our undergraduate instruction at that time included no unit operations, no separation processes in either laboratory or theory, no material and energy balances, no thermodynamics, no differential equations, no process control, no heat transmission, no fluid flow, no chemical kinetics, no process laboratory, no process dynamics, no transport phenomena. These courses are all essential parts of the training of a chemical engineer. We had none of them. We had no process equipment, no handbooks, no textbooks, no desk calculators. Slide rules were a novelty. In fact, we had no chemical engineering. as we know it now. Our training consisted in separate courses in chemistry and physics, mechanics and mechanical engineering, but without any integration into a common profession. Our instruction consisted in reading descriptions of methods of chemical manufacture without any mathematical treatment and little scientific analysis. This was back in 1911. We read about the descriptions of the manufacture of Portland cement and paint and dye stuffs and so forth, written by authors who had little experience in the field, and descriptions that represented practice which was always obsolete. The whole field of petroleum technology at that time was covered in 20 pages, whereas today 20,000 pages would be inadequate to even touch upon the field of petroleum technology. In fact, I recall that at that time there was one chemical engineer involved in the research and development in the petroleum technology, William Burton, in the whole field of petroleum technology, and that one man was supposed to saturate the field, whereas there would be 20,000 today. In 1911, the United States had very few companies engaged in chemical manufacture. All our fine chemicals and pharmaceuticals at that time came from Germany. So that our instruction at that time consisted pretty largely in reading German or translations of German. And our professors were also trained in Germany. At that time, America was bilingual and retained many of the customs and the language of the racial origin. Unfortunately, the World War I brought upon a great change in that regard, and there's been a loss of those very valuable assets. Well, I'm going to give you a development of chemical engineering education in the United States during these 50 years. And I want to also indicate the losses and gains and the present shortcomings, particularly the shortcomings of the curriculum that we have in the United States is adapted to this country, and the necessity of variety. In the United States, each school is allowed to develop its own curriculum. These changes are controlled entirely by the faculty at a given school, and the state or government has nothing to say about it. We prescribe to minimum standards set up by the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, the Engineering Committee for Professional Development. Well, rather than cover the United States, I've just taken one representative, the University of Wisconsin, because I think it is representative of the others. And I also want to say that the development with us was made by trial and error and by fumbling and making mistakes, as well as by careful planning. The first chart will show you the curriculum. First chart, please. At Wisconsin, in 1906, as compared to the curriculum in 1960. The arrows, the following arrows indicate that credits have been dropped. The rising arrows indicate that credits have been decreased. If 1906, instruction depended very heavily upon other departments of engineering, because we had no professional power of our own, upon mechanics and machine design, hydraulics, surveying, machine mechanisms, engineering thermodynamics, and our laboratories were also in drawing, in machines, and in mechanical testing. The chemical engineering courses were really reading courses, taught through flow charts, chemical reactions and machinery with little theory, quantitative treatment. But as the 50 years went by, the engineering service courses were dropped and professional power was developed within their own department. So notice here that in these 50 years, the chemistry content has increased 50%, despite the great reduction in quantitative analysis. Two-thirds has been removed. In fact, at MIT, quantitative analysis is not taught in chemical engineering. I think that's carrying it too far. In physics, much of the classical physics has been replaced by atomic structure. In mathematics, the same requirements, I mean the same number of credits now as 50 years ago, but great changes have taken place. We now require 4 years of mathematics in our secondary school, as you have always done in your gymnasium. So our students like yours now come to us with beginning calculus and mathematical analysis, which permits us to teach differential equations as a required course now. Mechanics has been cut in half. The emphasis in electrical engineering for chemical engineers has been shifted over to electronics. The courses, service courses in mechanical engineering have disappeared. That is, the engineering in engine thermodynamics and mechanisms and machine design have been replaced by our own courses. The civil engineering service courses have been eliminated, like surveying, hydraulics, contracts, and specifications. And the thesis requirements. Thesis and German have been eliminated. That isn't particularly desirable, but it was essential, it seemed, at the time. Of course, the thesis and German are still required for the doctorate training. Now, the courses given by the chemical engineering staff, right here, all of these have been doubled, but all the courses taught in 1906 have disappeared. And the courses taught in 1960 were unknown to us. And they consist of the elementary principles of material and energy balances, of thermodynamics, of the transport properties, including theory and the measurements thereof, the transfer operations, the operations and process laboratory. This next should read applied kinetics. Material to construction, applied electrochemistry, process control, process design. These constitute the what we consider essential courses in chemical engineering. Then it would be desirable to observe the changes that have taken place in the various decades in the next slide. And we might indicate the first two decades as belonging to industrial chemistry, in which the pattern was identical to that used in Europe at the same time. And during these two decades, surveying, hydraulics, mechanics, part of it, machine design, and part of quantitative analysis were replaced by these have gone out and those have gone in, and have been replaced by metallography, pyrometry, material and energy balances. See, the curriculum is in a constant state of flux, and that's desirable. In the next decade of unit operations, the descriptive geometry and contracts and specifications and part of mechanics disappeared in favor of the fundamentals of chemical engineering and some additional chemistry and unit operations. The next slide, please, will show the decade from 1936 to 1946, where more emphasis was placed on thermodynamics and process control. It takes many years to develop these particular applications. And power machinery and industrial chemistry, mechanics and electrochemistry part of it disappeared in favor of process control, more unit operation, and thermodynamics. In the next decade, we might indicate that as one in process design, and more on the professional responsibilities. More of practically all industrial chemistry disappeared, and metallography was properly transferred to the Department of Metallurgy. Machine design disappeared, power laboratory, some electrical engineering, and more physical chemistry was brought in, process design, some electronics replaced this, unit operation. But one thing that is noteworthy here is that more attention was given to report writing and speech at the request of our professional men in practice. It found that graduates were too inarticulate when it comes to speech and also in report writing. Then we come to the period of 1956 up to date, where chemical engineering became more of a science. And the remaining of mechanical engineering, thermodynamics, and then part of engineering drawing and technical analysis, and more mechanics were thrown out in place of differential equations and the transport phenomena. Just talked now in the beginning of the junior year with both theory and laboratory. In 1952, we undertook a more scientific approach to chemical engineering. For 50 years, we had patiently waited for the Department of Physics to present the problems of transport phenomena. But the gap between our hopes and performance continually increased rather than decreased. And the physicists naturally turned their interest over into the boundaries, the unknown boundaries of science, into nuclear physics and so forth, and that was proper. But it meant that we finally ourselves had to take care of the responsibility of giving a basic course in transport phenomena. And we were very fortunate in securing a young man by the name of Robert Byrd, who was visited here, lectured here, who had had 3 years of training in theoretical chemistry with Dr. Joseph Hirschfelder, followed by 1 year at Delft. Then I secured a National Science Foundation fellowship for him so he could spend 2 years just in concentrating on that one course. It's an assignment that other professors of chemical engineering could have done, but you don't have time. We gave him virtually 7 years to develop that course, and it took us off dead center in the development of the chemical engineering science. His book has recently been published by Byrd, Stewart, and Lightfoot. And we feel that this course in transport phenomena is an essential and desirable introduction to the unit operations and to fluid mechanics and to heat transmission and to reaction rates. The students realize, after they've had this fundamental course, the limitations of the empirical development that follow, and at the same time they develop more confidence in the empirical correlations, like in fluid flow and the turbulent conditions. There's no theoretical development of that particular subject that's adequate, and the reason for that is readily apparent. Then we gave a course in process design to replace the last vestige of industrial chemistry as far as our school was concerned. And that's a very good course in that it permits a comprehensive review of all the past courses applied to a specific industrial problem of design, and introduces the subject of engineering economics, which is so essential with us. We're in such a highly competitive condition. This course is ideal as far as student development is concerned, but imposes a tremendous time-consuming responsibility on the faculty. Well, now, let's show you the curriculum that we have at Wisconsin. I'm going to show the next slide. I'm going to show you the curriculum. We have the credit system. 1 credit of instruction is equivalent to a laboratory lecture period or recitation of 50 minutes, or to a laboratory period of 1.5 hours, and includes 1.5 hours of home study, so that 1 credit is equivalent to 3 hours of performance in the lecture room, recitation, laboratory, home. 151 credits is required, which involves about 7,700 hours of concentrated work, which can theoretically be covered in 8 semesters and 1 summer, usually requires on the average of 9 semesters. You'll notice in this curriculum that we have 8 paths. 4 are indicated here, path 1, 2. The first path is on mathematics, 18 credits, 12%. The next core path is on chemistry. Now, everything below the heavy line, our course is taught by the staff of chemical engineering, which means that they have the last chance, and that the termination of instruction is always given there, which means that they have to be up to date in these developments. In other words, there shall be no letdown in intellectual achievement in this final year. So that we have in our department electrochemistry applied. I think we're one of the few institutions in the United States that give a course that require electrochemistry in the chemical engineering curriculum, as you do here. The past three are the equilibrium studies, which include stoichiometry, the elementary principles, material energy balances, and thermodynamics. The fourth path represents the rate processes, which of course are based first of all upon general physics, and then we come into the transport phenomena, this new development, which we think is very fundamental. It removes a lot of the obscurity that we've previously had in teaching unit operations. We teach them very definitely in that course the principles of viscosity and thermal conductivity and all the difficulties involved in diffusion in the three coordinates of space and under steady and non-steady conditions and so on. It involves, of course, differential equations. Then that's followed up by the transfer operations and the separation processes, both theory and lab. And then in applied kinetics and in process design. Next slide shows path five, which represents the materials of construction, which began with some metal processing in the shop work when the boys are young, they want to develop coordination, and mechanics, and materials testing, and then our own course under the heavy line of materials of construction in chemical processing. Obviously, they're much different. That's 10 credits, 2%. And six, path six, is process control and dynamics. In America, the 1/3 of the cost of a chemical plant is in instruments for control and measurement. So we emphasize the importance of giving instruction in that field. And that's, of course, preceded by courses in electronics. And that will also include process dynamics. The next path is one on communication. That is all the means that we have for conveying ideas one to another. That is, with English composition and public speaking and engineering report writing. And with report writing, we require our own instructional staff to do the instruction, because they're the ones that would be familiar, of course, and are interested in the development of the students in this matter of expression. Now, you might say that the thing that's lacking here is the foreign language, but that's quite common in the United States. We don't have contact. We don't have everyday contact with foreign countries. We're remote. And the situation is entirely different here. And still it's regrettable, but it just doesn't allow room for foreign language until we get it either in the secondary schools or in, and it's required for a doctor's degree. The last is the electives. Now, of course, I don't know to what extent that you have electives here, but see, we require about 14% 22 credits. And that's because we're associated with a large university where we have all the other disciplines present. And we feel for the development of the student that that's quite essential. I might also say in this regard, however, that we have nothing so unique as your own studentus sumpun, which certainly in a great measure offsets this particular lack, if it does exist. Well, the next chart shows the relationship, the next, of the profession of our undergraduate and graduate training with to professional duties. I can't show it all here, but here is a cross plot of the previous. Undergraduate in training, the basic service courses, the mathematics courses, the chemistry courses, the physics courses, the general engineering, communication. These are the undergraduate courses that are taught outside of the department. The next slide is a continuation of this. Continue on. Then we have all the courses that are taught by our own staff in chemical engineering, in thermodynamics, and in operations and processes. You'll find the paths running through materials of construction, process control, all leading and funneling through a course in process design, which brings together and reviews to the student in a comprehensive manner all that they've had before, assigned to a given definite problem. And then over here, we have the professional duties as distributed in the United States, and I think they're quite different. We find that we have these graduate courses: heat transmission, thermodynamics, kinetics, distillation, advanced problems, fluids, particle mechanics, diffusional operations, corrosion, and so on. Advanced studies and thesis are, of course, required for the higher echelons of service in research and development and in teaching and in process design. Whereas those that don't take graduate work can undertake such things as process control and plant operations and technical sales and technical service. I don't know whether you have that distribution of functions in Norway or not, but I do know that in general, you train your students for the higher echelons of performance of professional service in nearly all the branches. But with our larger numbers, we recognize that a great percentage are not qualified for the higher echelons of professional service. Well, this type of a curriculum, and the same as you have here, is a very difficult challenge for both the students and the faculty. It keeps you forever on your toes with very few idle hours. Now, I've given you the curriculum at Wisconsin, but that has a great deal of variations in the United States. And these variations are left up to the faculty and are determined by the presence of local industries, natural resources, and faculty interest, just as it should be, and just as it is here. Certainly, your curriculum has to be built up with some attention to the conditions here in Norway. Now, in this transition, certain losses and gains are bound to develop. We might turn on the light now. I think that's the last slide. 50 years ago, and earlier, it was the responsibility of the chemical engineer to engage in the development of the heavy chemical industries, the ammonia soda process, acids, alkalis, and salts, the recovery of chemicals from wood and coal, and so forth. And this he did with no data on heat mass or momentum transfer, no training in process design or in kinetics or in any of these other subjects. But he did possess a great deal of imagination, ingenuity, and resourcefulness, which have somewhat been sacrificed. I think they've been sacrificed to a greater extent in the United States than here. I think it's been quite characteristic in Europe that those things should come first. There's been a loss in the thesis, or having special problems which challenge the student, develop his enthusiasm and originality and ingenuity, as in the recovery of waste byproducts and stream pollution, and the recovery of waste gases and the byproducts from wood and coal. Even though the students' solutions are not satisfactory, it's a challenging thing to them. Develops this enthusiasm, of course, and you can do more, and you remember more the things that you do from your own enthusiasm than the problems that are assigned to you. That's quite manifest and evident from the performance that I saw at the Studentus Sumfund last Saturday night. You can do a lot with student enthusiasm. Now, our thesis requirement was eliminated. And that's, of course, undergraduate. That's an unfortunate loss. But it is required because we had this big influx into graduate work. Our enrollment started to increase, and we had limited laboratory facilities, and the staff was overloaded. And the staff was giving their attention to doctorate training rather than to undergraduate theses. That's the reason. One of the courses that I think that we ought to have, that we don't have, that is a course in organic process principles. But I mean this. I don't mean additional course in organic chemistry. I mean the translation of organic process principles to engineering. And that translation isn't so easy or obvious. And it can't be done by just reading the theoretical course. And we've done that, for instance, in stoichiometry, and in thermodynamics, and in kinetics. It's important to get the engineering version of this, because we need a better understanding of organic process principles, not from the standpoint of synthesis or analysis, but from the standpoint of engineering problems involving adsorption and catalysis and reaction rates. We'll have to take some of the guesswork out of this hunting for a catalyst and so forth. I think a course like that is even more important than one in applied kinetics, because it had been hoped that a course in applied kinetics might restore some of this inventiveness, this resourcefulness in chemistry. But unfortunately, it shakes down to about the same thing. We use the given rate equations to establish optimum conditions of construction and operation. We're concerning ourselves with small details and small economies and forgetting about the more exciting problems of chemical development. I mean, that's the way it is with us. I'm giving you the criticism of our own curriculum. Then this curriculum that I've given here is very fine in America for the large industries where they have specialization. But in the smaller industries, they require versatility. They don't care if a man has such a highly advanced theoretical training as they do that he should have a broad training. Then another transition that's a little regrettable here is the loss in emphasis on engineering. Well, you know, there are many that will argue that technical education should be restricted to pure mathematics and pure scientific principles, and leaving all the conjectures of economics and experience to later life. Well, if this were true, we wouldn't need any technical institutes or engineering colleges. We'd leave it all to the departments of mathematics and science. But that isn't the way life goes on. We find that regardless of the superior scientific attainment of the mathematician and the physicist, the chemist, the problems of responsible design and construction and operation are left to the engineer. All these principles of mathematics that we teach today were known 100 years ago. It's been developed by Legrand, Bernoulli, and Fourier. It's only the high-speed calculators that have been developed in recent years that make their application feasible. I think we still have to teach our students that there are a lot of problems that can be solved, engineering problems, that can be solved more directly with greater confidence and greater saving of time by empirical methods or by experimentation than by mathematical formulations or scientific investigations, immediate solutions. The engineer that designed, the greatest designer of the diesel engine, had no thermodynamics. Young engineers leaving the institute are inclined to want to study the effect of all the variables before they turn in the report. The result is that the process is obsolete before they get the data. You've got to use a lot of good judgment on knowing when to terminate experimentation and what to leave to good judgment. You've got to compromise between the necessity of getting this thing rolling against the pinpointing of all the variables. And then there's a great field in chemical engineering where the science is most inadequate. That's certainly true with the solid state. The whole field of the selection of solid catalysts is just most obscure. Imagine taking 20,000 experiments to perfect the Haber process. Now, for instance, in the art of filtration, that is, much of engineering is still of art, and filtration is such. Now, usually, in a few hours of experimentation, you can determine the performance of a filter. And yet, if you were to attempt a theoretical analysis of it, it would require a completely theoretical analysis, require many, many years. Or the extraction of water from a textile. You can perform and get the data by a centrifugal separation in a few minutes, where a theoretical analysis would take many years. And so it is in the whole field of these operations that require crushing and grinding and mixing and roasting, calcining. So many of these metallurgical processes, melting, drying, flotation, sedimentation, magnetic separation, electrostatic separation, we still depend very largely upon the art. The science hasn't caught up with it. And in the production of catalysts, a matter of pelleting, impregnation, calcination, activation, selection, still in the stage of art. One half of the world's petroleum supply has already been exhausted, and yet we possess only a fraction of the information that might be required for ideal processing. Perhaps I should close. Well, there's about 5 minutes, is that? I might indicate that in chemical engineering we need a lot of variety. We're always in a state of flux, and you've got to adapt your curriculum to the country in which you live, state in which you live. I recall visiting in Formosa, where a number of their engineers trained in America were setting up a plant for the production of urea. And they were following blueprints and dioramas. In that case, it would have been much better if these fellows had had training in machine design and mechanics and mechanical equipment rather than a lot of advanced courses in fluid mechanics. Their operations are all in batch. Their problems were one of selecting of equipment. In India, I encountered a number of engineers trained in America that were setting up and operating a DDT plant, insecticide plant. They were complaining about the training in the United States because it lacked emphasis on machine design and laboratory experiments and thesis and special problems, whereas they were concerned with courses in advanced theory and desk calculations. Showing you how a curriculum set up in one place is not suitable in another. Or in Thailand, Bangkok, found two young fellows trying to set up a course in chemical engineering. Each of them were teaching 26 hours a week. You see, it just can't be done. The most important thing is not building. They were setting up a lot. They were getting millions of dollars to set up of equipment. What they needed was more staff. That's the most essential thing, is to give these teachers time to breathe a little bit and not exhaust themselves. Now in Japan, for instance, I found that the economy there met an entirely different matter than it did in the United States. They can't afford graduate training. They can't afford too many advanced courses. They've got to learn English too, and German, because they're inarticulate with the rest of the world unless they have a strange language, you know. And so in a course like that, or in a country like that, instruction in industrial chemistry to chemical engineering was 20 to 1. United States is about 0 to 1, but it's justified because they needed specialists. They could only take 4 years. They couldn't take other years for advanced work. Little demand by industry for advanced degrees. So those things were thoroughly justified. And of course, Japan is the most advanced country in all the Orient as far as technical development is concerned. They're equal to any other country in technical development. And then they have so many small industries which need versatility rather than specialization. I think that is about all. I just want to conclude that what I have said today was in the development of a curriculum of chemical engineering, letting it approach a more highly scientific level. I've indicated the gains and losses, and I've also indicated the need for variety.
Thank you very much.